You're about to listen to an interview with Alexandra Hudson. She's the author of the recently published book, The Soul of Civility. In an effort to create a public affairs show centered around good faith debate and civil discussions, Doug and I thought we'd kick off this rejuvenated Lynn Cannell voice with this interview. In her book, Hudson has compiled writings from across time and cultures, including writers from the ancient Egyptians and Sumeria, to Chinese Confucians and Christian saints, to tackle this timeless problem of how we get along with our neighbors. I think it's easy to forget in Haines, a town that has its fair share of divisiveness, that we aren't unique in the challenges that these problems present. Hudson's book has a lot of great advice for how to navigate these issues. We hope you enjoy the conversation. So we'll just get right into a couple of the things that Doug and I wanted to cover. And I was going to start, and I was just going to read from the early part of the book about distinguishing civility and politeness. And in the book you write, "Civility promotes the rigorous debate that might on the surface seem impolite, but nevertheless authentically respects others. Once we recognize the difference between politeness and civility, we see that politeness is unequal to the task of healing our social, political, and cultural rifts. Politeness is easy. Civility requires effort." And you later go on to talk about how a civil society or nation, it really lies within the character of its people rather than its institutions or monuments or sciences or whatever. So could you go into the difference between civility and politeness?
Absolutely. So I was, but to my interest in this topic, honestly, my mother is something of an expert on civility and manners. She's called Judy the Manners Lady. And I was raised in this home, attentive to social norms and social expectations. I always questioned them. You know, why do we do things the way we do them? And I hungered for rationale behind, you know, our customs and social norms. But I followed what my mother told me to do, because she promised they would, following these norms would lead to success in school and work and life. And she was right, until I found myself in federal government. I was at the United States Department of Education 2017 to 2018, and very deeply divided season, as you might be aware. And I was in this environment of like anti-human flourishing. It was just absolutely frustrating. I felt I saw people instrumentalized and depersonalized, dehumanized. I saw these two extremes. On one hand, there were people who were they had sharp elbows, and they were bullies. They were willing to step on anyone to get ahead. And on the other hand, there were people who were polished and poised and polite. These are the people who at first I thought were my people. But these are the people who would smile at me one moment and stab me in the back the next. And this really threw me, because one thing my mother had said to me growing up was that manners mattered, because they were an outward expression of our inward character. And here I was surrounded by people who were well-mannered and yet ruthless and cruel. And so that clarified for me this essential distinction between civility and politeness. So politeness is manners, it's etiquette, it's external, it's technique, whereas civility is internal. It's a disposition of the heart, a way of seeing others as our moral equals, who are worthy of a bare minimum of respect just because of our shared moral status as members of the human community, and that sometimes, crucially, actually respecting someone requires being impolite, telling hard truths, engaging in robust debate. And so I argue throughout the book that there is this essential and underappreciated distinction between civility and politeness, and that we need to aim to cultivate the disposition of civility. That's what will help us navigate this fraught and divided time, and not be content with the tone policing, the faux respect, the faux niceness of politeness.
Great, thank you. And just to help listeners, could you give a definition of civility?
Civility is the bare minimum of respect that we are owed and owe to others by virtue of our shared personhood, our dignity, our irreducible moral worth as human beings. And again, crucially, that sometimes requires being impolite. So I love etymology. Etymology, the history and story of our language, is throughout the book. And the etymology of these two words, civility and politeness, supports this distinction. So the etymology of politeness is polere, which means to polish or to smooth over, and that's what politeness does. It polishes over difference as opposed to giving us the tools to grapple with difference head on. The etymology of civility is civitas, which is city or citizenship, and that is what civility is. It's the habit and the conduct befitting a citizen in the city. And that's what we need to support our democracy and our free and flourishing society.
You also write about, you use an example of the root word of kind, and you talk about how it's natural for humans to treat their own well, but civility requires sort of reaching beyond yourself or your clan to the other. And the root of kind is kin. Could you delve a little bit more into that?
Exactly. So it's the most natural thing in the world to treat our kin well, our tribe well. And this is what is beautiful about the etymology of the word kindness. It comes from kin, and it means treating strangers as if they were our kin, extending that logic of who we owe respect to, love to, hospitality to, and generalizing it to the stranger. So it's this unnatural thing. It's this thing that's hard to do sometimes, just, you know, showing kindness to utter stranger, showing kindness and respect to the person that we differ from, disagree with, the person who can do nothing for us in return. That's what's really easy about showing decency to others based on these kinship ties, based on people whom we have things in common with, who we like. But how do we treat people across the divide? That's the real test of civility. And the soul of civility, if you will, and that's the ethos of true kindness as well.
I think this will segue into what Doug wants to talk about in terms of treating strangers with that dynamic. But in Haines here, a town of 2,500, we're mostly not strangers, but we still have our groups and our tribes, so to speak. And Doug was interested in one part of your book. I'll let him jump in here.
Yeah, Lexi, in your chapter on the polarization and tolerance, you give a story about the early 1990s Congress changing their work schedule with and losing that ability with them flying home for the weekend so they could be in their districts more, hear from their constituents. There was kind of a loss of the interaction between different members of Congress and the Senate. And you talk about how that affects their ability to work together and how that might have led to the discourse that we have back in Washington, D.C. now. Could you touch on that story and give a little more in-depth on that?
Yes, I love this story. I feel like people's eyes might glaze over during that story, but I love talking about it because it's so fascinating. I pore over dozens of hours of C-SPAN archives learning about this civility summit, these series of civility summits. In the late 1990s, early 2000s, so it was thought that incivility had reached a fever pitch in American public life, and something had to be done about it. And this unprecedented amount of philanthropic and civic support to do something about it happened. And so the Aspen Institute and a Pew Charitable Trust got together. And they, I think they put like nearly $1 million into these civility summits. The first one was in 1997, I believe. And all of Congress and their spouses, I think about half of Congress, everyone was invited, but half of Congress went to Hershey, Pennsylvania. And half the time they spent talking about how they could work together more effectively across their disagreement and differences. And the other half of the time in Hershey, Pennsylvania, at the Civility Summit, was just unstructured free time, just like, you know, playing with kids and family and friends and eating together. And it was unbelievably productive and helpful. Everyone who went to the summit came back feeling rejuvenated, hopeful, refreshed, and feeling really encouraged and hopeful about the state of American public life after the summit. And Even Newt Gingrich and Tip O'Neill said, you know, we should do this every year. This is just so good to restore the bonds of working relationships because it had gotten really high stakes. And you know, people, even then in the C-SPAN footage, there was talk of the media incentives. Like, this is, you know, 25 years ago, before the age of social media, but they talked about the perverse incentives of media to that rewarded the incendiary and inflammatory and attacks. And they talked about how Congress didn't live in Washington anymore. Everyone went back to their districts. And that meant they didn't see each other socially. Their kids didn't go to school together. That civic bonds and bonds of friendship were strained, and that had a carryover effect into on the floors of Congress. And so there are all these concerns that we still hear about today, in fact. And everyone was just, you know, in this tizzy that they found a solution. Like, all we had to do was have these civility summits, and civic bonds had been restored. There was hope again for American civic life. And then guess what happened? The Monica Lewinsky scandal. And immediately all bets were off. Any gains that had been made in trust and civic friendship were immediately lost. And it was war once again. And then there was an attempt to do another civility summit a year or two after that, and then one more in the early 2000s. And none had been as successful as this original event. What I love about this story is that it illustrates a theme throughout my book, is that, you know, our democracy is at core about friendship. Like, we need friendship. We need civic friendship. We need civic trust. And that democracy, friendship, civilization itself is exquisitely fragile. It is never a foregone conclusion. It is always highly precarious. And it takes vigilance. It takes day in, day out, minute by minute, sacrifice, effort in order to sustain it. And that is what this story shows, that, like, you know, people had made the sacrifice. They'd gone to the civility summit, and civic bonds are restorable. They can be restored. Trust can be rebuilt. That's one lesson as well. But it's fragile. It's not a foregone conclusion. The moment you put, you know, civilization, friendship, democracy on autopilot, that's the beginning of the end. So thanks for asking about that story.
Well, and I'd like to tie that into another story that you have that might relate more to the small town atmosphere in Haines. All our elected representatives, we see them on the streets, we see them in town. But you're telling the story about your mom with the front porch, and how we've gone from a front porch facing the street where you're seeing your neighbors, you're inviting them into the living room, to the back patio where it's more secluded, you're kind of in your own environment, and how that affects our civility towards others, is we're not having that that same interaction with our neighbors. And that leads to the same issue with the civility, is we're not getting that practice ourselves. Is that an accurate read on your writing?
That's exactly right. And I have this metaphor that I unpack in the book of the front porch. And so part of my story is that I fled D.C. I call myself a refugee from federal government, this toxic, divisive state. And I fled to Indianapolis, Indiana. My husband is from Indiana originally. And I had this in my mind, this vision of, like, you know, rolling bucolic pastures. That's what I longed for out of the, in contrast to the cesspool that was Washington. And I came home from work one day and said to my husband, I'm done with government. I'm done with D.C. Let's move to Indiana. And he said, okay, no take backs. And a few months later, we had moved to Indianapolis. And one of my first friends I met while here in Indiana was a woman named Joanna Taft. And she said to me, she came up to me after church one day and said, hi, I'm Joanna. Would you like to porch with us sometime? And I had never heard the word porch used as a verb before, but I was curious. And so I we went to her house that afternoon, and I realized that Joanna was staging a quiet revolution from her front porch, a quiet revolution of healing our other divisions in our world and in our country right now. She had curated on her front porch people across politics, across class, across race, across geography in town, in order to just pass the time together, just inhabit a shared space. She had created an oasis from the divided nature of our world right now, where people could be seen and known and loved just by virtue of who they were as a human being, without any of these labels that the world right now wants to ascribe value to and wants us to locate our primary identity in. And what I realized is that there are people like Joanna across the country. They're saying, I can't change what's happening in Washington, but I can change myself. And that enough of us choosing to reclaim the soul of civility, the disposition of coaching, hospitality, showing kindness to a stranger, that can and will change the world. And so I use the porch as a metaphor, but also as a sort of practical way that we can each be a part of the solution right now, because it's not even really about the porch. I mean, Joanna happens to live in this beautiful, you know, historic home with a great big front veranda, but I met people across the country who used their front lawns, you know, who had supper clubs, weekly supper clubs in their dining room, or they used their front stoop, or they held court at a local coffee shop, you know, held these sort of office hours. It's about creating a space where people can come into life and be seen and known and loved, and where people are intentional about transforming the outsider to the insider, stranger into the friend. And we can do that too.
I think I said earlier that in Haines, most people aren't strangers to one another, but I think in a sense they are, maybe, because what you mentioned about trying to fit someone in a label is that if you've lived here long enough or even a few years, you can flatten people. There's a tendency to flatten someone based on what you think you know about them. So maybe in essence, they really are strangers. So what are a couple tips if someone wants to sort of flex these civility muscles to break through that dynamic?
There are so many things you can do right now. Like, I'm a big fan of hospitality. I have a whole chapter in my book dedicated to hospitality. And I am very, quick to acknowledge it's hard. It's uncomfortable sometimes. It's like a muscle. And choosing to invite someone into your home, you know, reach out of your comfort zone, risk rejection, inviting someone out to lunch even or into your home, it's difficult. But it's kind of like going to the gym. Like, you never regret it. I love the story of Eumaeus. I talk about Homer's Odyssey. So Eumaeus, he is someone, he's a character in Homer's Odyssey. He's someone who has very little in the way of material possessions. He's a slave in ancient Greece on the island of Ithaca. And yet one day he encounters a stranger who has even less than he does, someone who's clearly more in need than Eumaeus himself is. And what does he do? He says, "Welcome, friend." He invites him into his home, offers him a bath, offers him a meal, offers him a place to lay his head for the night. And only after he's provided for all of his basic needs, Eumaeus says to him, "So tell me your story." And Eumaeus is delighted to discover that this stranger, this impoverished stranger he's hosted in his home, is his long-lost master, Odysseus, in disguise as a beggar. And there's this beautiful reunion because Eumaeus's character was revealed in this moment where he showed kindness to someone, again, we were talking about this earlier, who could do nothing for him in return, who he might never see again, who was not part of his, who wasn't obviously part of his immediate kin or tribe. And that sort of ethic of hospitality, of kindness to stranger, is celebrated all throughout the Homer's Odyssey, but also throughout other ancient cultures and traditions as well, including the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, in Arabian culture, the character of Sinbad is constantly being tricking people who are bad hosts and rewarding people who are good hosts. And it just goes on and on that there's this rich and vibrant tradition of hospitality as being, you know, showing kindness to the stranger, the person that we can, that we'll never see again, that can never do anything for us in return. It's this high and noble expression of civility that we can start with right now in ways great and small.
I was really blown away by the breadth of examples throughout the book, from ancient Egyptians to Confucians to the Hebrew Bible, of this sort of timeless problem and efforts to overcome
it. Exactly. Yes. Sorry, what was that?
And efforts to overcome it.
That's exactly right. That is a core argument of my book, that this is the most important question of our day. How do we flourish across deep difference? But it is also a timeless question. It's the defining human question. It's the question we've been grappling with as a species for as long as we've been around, because we are profoundly, and it's because of two facets of our nature. We are profoundly social as a species. We become fully human in relationship with others, and yet morally and biologically, we are geared to meet our own needs before others. And those two things are intention. The social and the self-love in our nature. And that is why in all times and all places, community, friendship, democracy, civilization itself is never a foregone conclusion. It is always fragile. And it lives and dies on individuals' decisions to live with civility, to sacrifice the self for the sake of the human social project.
And Lexi, I like it at the end of your chapter on civil society, where you talk about integrity builds trust, trust builds social capital. All of these in turn support our freedom, our democracy, our globalized market economy, and our civil society. None of these can be mandated by government policy. And then you go on in your steps at the end of the chapter on how to restore trust, civility, and civil society and save democracy. Number 6 is don't assume the worst about others. Hold on to your emotional and mental energy by telling stories of exoneration, not condemnation. And that really struck me, because that's so many times I have people associate my motives to things that I've never talked about. Well, you did this because of this. And I think giving that grace and the exoneration, not condemnation, is a great way to be meeting new people and getting to better understand their viewpoint.
That's exactly correct. I think it's just our human nature. You know, psychologists will call it the fundamental attribution error. We're always a little bit more generous and gracious with ourselves than we are with others. Like, we know our reasons for being late. We know our reasons for having XYZ opinion on this issue, but we don't know what's going on in other people's heads. And so we're more gracious with ourselves because we know our rationale, our reasoning. We don't know what's going on with others. And that causes us to be less gracious. And it causes us to tell these stories of condemnation. Like, that person is a bad person because they cut me off in traffic. Not like, oh, that's a person having a bad day or being thoughtless. Or they're on their way, rushing their wife to the hospital to have a baby. You know, like, we don't think outside the box. We go right to the worst possible explanation, the one that's most egregious and insulting to us. And we kind of nurse those wounds, and we tell those ourselves those stories that fit that that view of the world that everyone's out to get us. And it takes conscious effort. I think that's like, that is an expression of our self-love, our fundamental orientation towards the self, because we're, again, only thinking about ourselves. We're not thinking about other people's views or positions or circumstances. But how do we shift that? How do we train our minds to think of others first, others alongside of ourselves? My grandmother was someone who was exceptional at telling these stories of exoneration. She was so good at seeing what I call the thing beneath the thing. She was excellent at seeing, you know, the story behind someone's, you know, bad attitude or thoughtless action. And she, when someone bit her head off, like, she's like, that's not about me. That's more about them. And she would even try again. And she would think to herself, how can I make this person's day a little bit better? And she was just exceptional at that. And that's definitely an area of growth for me. The baser part of myself tends to tell those stories of condemnation instinctively. So I'm always trying to do better in that regard. But I am really grateful to have an example in my grandmother, who, even though she's, you know, no longer with us, continues to teach and inspire me to do better.
Yeah, it seems like I encounter this so much running the newspaper here, is that people will, it's almost like an unconscious tick, like you assume the worst or you go straight to conspiracy. And it strikes me that you have to sort of be aware that you're going to do this. So if you can catch yourself doing it, that's when you can make the change.
Exactly.
Well, we have a couple minutes left. Is there anything you want to wrap this up, and anything you want to say that we didn't ask about that you think Haines residents should hear?
Well, thank you too, and thank you, Haines, for your passion for getting people to talk well together across difference. This is the most important problem of our day. but it's also not one that can be left. It's too important to be left to our national leaders and to be delegated to national authorities. This is a local, an individual problem. The solution starts in individual hearts and in communities. It's where it's lived out and practiced, these habits of democracy, these habits of flourishing across difference. And so thank you to each of you for fostering this conversation in your community.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Lexi. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Lexi. Great book.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys. Happy New Year.
Yeah. Have a good day.
Bye.
Okay. So that was our interview. What do you think, Doug?
I really love the book, and thank you for recommending it. And for those that didn't catch it at the beginning, it's The Soul of Civility, Timeless Principles to Hear Society and Ourselves by Alexandra Hudson. There's numerous opportunities in here and examples on how to practice what we've just been talking about for the last half hour. And, you know, your question to Lexi about how do we put this into practice in our own community, in our own houses. At the end of each chapter, she has several points on how you can make this happen. And there are places that how do we recognize other people? How do we allow them into our house? How do we invite them into social situations that they might not be already going to and expose them to different ideas? And then also the grace of recognizing that just because somebody says no the first time doesn't mean that they're not interested, but they might have something else going on in their life. There might be other reasons, and to keep extending that olive branch out to others.
Yeah, there was thinking about how to apply all this to Haines. I was reminded during the election season, and I can't remember who it was, but I was kind of monitoring Facebook chatter, and it usually isn't something that, you know, ends well or solves much on those comments, but someone was making a statement about a political issue, and one of the planning commissioner candidates said, "Hey, would you like to meet?" And then apparently that person went to this person's house. They had some disagreements. Maybe they left with disagreements, but just the act of going into that person's home, having a conversation, I'm sure those people got to see each other, not as strangers, but as neighbors. And I would suspect they left seeing each other as a little more human and less as political rivals, even though they maybe even still disagreed about some things.
And if you want somebody to agree 100% with you, look in the mirror. It's the only person that's going to agree with you 100%. And I think recognizing everybody's different backgrounds and experiences and learning from those experiences. We all have our core principles that we're not going to budge on, but understanding how other people got to their core principles that they're not going to judge on can help find a way that at least we can have a good conversation about the issue in front of us and find a solution rather than to keep fighting about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and before the interview with Lexi, you and I were discussing that, and we talked about it with Lexi, but that tendency to see the worst in others or assume the worst, whether it's their motives, their intentions, that seems like such a common thing here. I would have people bring a newspaper to me circling all the examples of bias that they saw. And maybe they were right sometimes, but I just think if you go into something looking for the worst, you're going to find it whether it's there or not. Your experience as mayor, how did that manifest?
There's a lot of times in a public meeting, people would come up and tell us the reason this is in front of us is because of this. And I had never even thought of that aspect of it. I was like, wow, that was never part of a conversation. That was never part of a thought process. But when they saw that, that was where they thought what we were trying to do as the borough government. And that was never part of any of our planning. And it got to that after a few of those, it's like, okay, how are other people going to be viewing this? Mm-hmm. And it's hard because without understanding other people's past experience and how they're thinking about things and knowing everybody intimately, which is impossible, you're not going to know where people are going to go with different thoughts on that. And it was frustrating too because our all borough meetings are very rigid. People get up to have their public comment and it's basically stating an opinion. Then you have other people stating an opinion, might be the same, might be different. And after your public comment and stating of opinions, you get up to the front and the planning commission assembly, they get to state their opinions. Sometimes there's a little bit of a debate, but most of time it's stating of opinions and then you have a vote. There's not a good way in our form of government to have a large community conversation about something and trying to bring people together into living rooms to have these discussions with different user groups. And that I think you and I have talked about, we're hoping as this radio show goes forward to bring people in with diverging viewpoints, have a conversation, and maybe that broadens that perspective within the community and allow some of those conversations to take place before it gets to government action.
Yeah, and the goal of our show, not just to have a debate, but to try to understand where each person is coming from and why they think the way they do. It's not probably what the opposing side necessarily thinks.
Yeah, why are they opposed or why are they in favor of something besides just the bullet points that people want to say in their 3 minutes of public comment at an assembly meeting? What is it in their life history that they have seen or experienced that causes them fear or anxiety if a project doesn't go through or if a project does go through or if an ordinance goes through or not? Where are those trigger points, and better understanding that where somebody that's on the opposite side of you is coming from those viewpoints, I think ends up with a better process and a better end result.
Yeah. And one other thing I thought worth bringing up before we had our interview discussing the book, you and I both cited examples of hearing from people on both sides or multiple sides of political issues sort of wish that the other side would just die off. I literally had someone say, well, these people just need to die off or move away, or this whole section of a town needs to disappear. It's just, for one, it's dehumanizing. It's also extremely unrealistic. We have to learn tolerance and how to navigate these issues to live in a democracy, a pluralistic society.
And it's something that I had, as we talked about before we came on the air, same thing. Number of people, well, those people don't belong in Haines. Mm-hmm. They don't belong here. And it came from, it wasn't just from one side or another. Yeah. It came from a broad spectrum of the community. I heard this from numerous people. Well, mm-hmm. those people just don't belong here. We don't want them here. Mm-hmm. And that's terrifying, because you look at some of the examples that Lexi had in her book, that there are things, you know, with your civil disobedience, that being, having civil discourse doesn't mean that you can't also have civil disobedience. And she was talking about, you know, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and some of these historical figures that they saw human rights violations and people being treated unjustly, and they stood up for that. And there is a way to do that in a civil manner. But when you talk about these people don't belong here, you're talking about words that led to the Third Reich, of people not belonging here. And so if we don't wrap our heads around that and figure out and people that have said that, it's like, well, that's not what I meant. Mm-hmm. But it can lead that way. And so let's try and develop this civil discourse. Let's talk to our neighbors. Let's talk to people that have a different opinion for ourselves, so we can see that humanness in them, so we can see who they are as a person and why they became that way. And so we're not doing that condemnation of when somebody comes up with something disagreeing with us, that we're looking for the good in that person.
Right. Yeah. And another sort of comforting thing about this book is that it helped me keep in perspective that it's sort of our default mode to behave like that and think in that way. It's not totally, it's our natural state to sort of have those habits of thought, whether it's seeing the worst in others or thinking about ourselves or our tribe first. And that is just sort of how it goes. And it's the extra effort to sort of see beyond that, beyond yourself. That's sort of like Lexi said, going to the gym to work out, building that civility muscle. So when I hear things like they just need to die off, you know, it's sort of shocking at first, but it's also like, well, that's kind of how we are. We need to overcome that.
And like we had talked about I'm going to quote the same thing because it goes to exactly what you're talking about. And you and I aren't immune from these thoughts either.
No,
definitely. You know, we're not perfect. It's not like we have the civility thing nailed down, There's people that I have conversations with, like, man, just I don't want to deal with you. You are crazy. And trying to rework that in my head. And that the beginning of Lexi's book, when she talks about self-love and civility, and about that, our first instinct is to take care of ourselves, our kin, those close to us, and then maybe take care of other people. There's that, you need to have a balance between those. If we're going to live in a civil society, you have to give up some of that self-love in order to get to work as a society and to make sure that we're all working towards a common goal. And for me, reading that and recognizing that was very eye-opening, because it's like, yeah, okay, we're all looking out for ourselves mm-hmm. first, our family, our close friends, and then maybe the people that live 6 blocks away or 2 miles away. And so I think if we recognize that in ourselves, it helps us get past that and work on, okay, is it just good for me, or is this something that's also good for the community and society as a whole?
Right. Yeah. I think you and I are both sort of, well, first I want to reinforce, yeah, neither of us are immune from any of this stuff. And I've had the same thoughts, and I catch myself all the time making these either, you know, logical fallacies or the tribalism that I experience as well. I think maybe why you and I have an interest in this, we haven't talked about this, but I suspect, is that we were sort of, by virtue of our positions, forced to interact with different segments of the community. And so the sort of caricatures it's easy to build up in your mind of these people sort of dissolve when you actually sit down and talk to them and try to get their perspective.
Yeah. And for me, it started when I was on the assembly in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. that there was people that I had really good friendships with, that actions that I took on the assembly, I lost those friendships. And that was really hurtful. It's like, okay, I thought I was being elected to do what was best for the community. And there were certain people that it went against their interests, and they've held that against me for 14, 15 years now or longer. And that was tough to take in. But then also having conversations with people, being in retail, having conversations with people on a day-to-day basis about different things, and they're this friendly, happy-go-lucky, you can have conversation about anything. And then something would come up on the political, and you see them testifying in a assembly meeting or at a planning commission or any of those types of meetings, and it's a totally different person. And it got me thinking, how do we come about that change? How can we have those conversations that I can have somebody have with somebody across a store counter? How do we have that into government? And I thought, when I ran for mayor, to try and bring that respect, that civility, and trying to nurture those conversations was something that I was striving for. And I think we made some progress, but not nearly as much as I wanted, because you don't have the rules of engagement in those meetings is so strict that it really limits a lot of that discussion. And so that made it really hard. And I've told this story to numerous people, but one of my favorite people in Haines was Gary Aronson. He hasn't been here for a long time, but we differed on a lot of things, on our viewpoint, and we could have a very heated argument about who was right and wrong and bringing up different facts. And at the end of every conversation, it'd either be me like, "Hey, Gary, can't wait to see you again." Or he was, hey, Doug, this was a great conversation. And we always left with a smile and a handshake. And the next, it might be 2 months before we had a conversation like that again, that would get a little heated and we'd disagree and go back and forth. But every single one of them, we left as friends, as like, "Hey, can't wait to see you again." Hmm. And to have those, have somebody like that, that you can have that really strong dialogue with, still be civil, still look forward to seeing them the next time, was something that I still cherish today.
Yeah, I love that story. And maybe we should end there, because at the end of the day, like you said, we're never going to all agree with each other. Part of this whole thing is just learning how to disagree better.
Yes.
All right. Well, this is exciting. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Kyle.
All right. Well, hope you enjoyed the interview. Stay tuned for future shows when we plan to bring people on opposing sides of issues together to discuss them with the aspiration to live up to the values Hudson writes about. We'll not only dig into the various positions people are taking, but also ask questions that get at motivations and values. Questions like, what is oversimplified about this issue? How has the conflict affected your life? What do you think the other side wants? What do you and your supporters need to learn about the other side in order to understand them better? So thanks for listening. If you have ideas for topics or guests, just give us a call, 766-2020, or you can email me at gm@khns.org. Thank you.